You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to some estimates, hundreds of professionals around the world knew that Bernard Madoff was a fraud, but no one except Harry Markopoulos went to the Securities and Exchange Commission with their evidence. Formerly a securities industry executive and now an independent financial fraud investigator, Mr. Markopoulos is known as the Madoff whistleblower, and he tells his story in No One Would Listen, a True Financial Thriller, which is published by Wiley. I'm very pleased that it has brought Harry Markopoulos to our show today. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Some people would call you a hero, but haven't you said that this case has been something of a disaster all around?
There's nothing to feel good about. I certainly am not a hero. I wasn't brave. I was only frightened, and that's how we got to the other side of the case.
But although you weren't able to protect his victims, aren't there some things that you're proud of?
We saw him as a clear and present danger to this nation's capital markets, to our nation's reputation, and that's what kept us in the field for so long.
Well, this could be seen as a story of how you and your associates failed to stop Madoff, but do you think that he felt pressured to turn himself in, and in part because of the attention that you were putting on him?
No, he turned himself in because he stole money from the most powerful and sometimes the most dangerous people from around the globe. He was stealing from over 40 nations. And when you make those kind of enemies, you have no place to run or hide. He needed the safety of a prison cell.
What caused you to start suspecting that he was running a criminal operation?
Frank Casey from my team went down to New York, came back with a one-page marketing tear sheet in late 99. And when I looked at it, within 5 minutes, I knew it was a fraud. It was so obvious.
So that was 10 years before he finally was caught.
It was darn near a decade, and it's unfortunate, and we spotted it in 5 minutes, or at least I did, and I did about 4 hours of mathematical modeling and proved it was a fraud, and went to the SEC repeatedly, and they just didn't listen.
Did your boss at Rampart Investments in Boston suspect him as well?
They looked at the return stream. They knew how much money he was getting as fee income, and they said they wanted me to duplicate that strategy, and I told them I couldn't because it was based on fraud.
And that was it? I mean, did you even try?
Well, they kept pressuring me to try, and they kept saying that your math isn't as good as Bernie Madoff's, which made me infuriated. They kept saying, well, he's a member of all the exchanges. He has access to broker-dealer order flow. You just haven't figured it out. You're inadequate.
And he had also been the head of NASDAQ, which I'm sure made many people feel that they could trust him.
Like most white-collar fraudsters, he had an impeccable resume. He was chairman of NASDAQ. His brother was vice chairman. These two men sat on the most prestigious finance boards. They donated a lot to charity. They were philanthropists. They were political donors. They were widely respected in the community.
Now, how would you explain his strategy to someone who's not trained in finance? Is this just a classic Ponzi scheme, or did it have certain sophisticated subtleties?
It had derivatives mathematics. It was a complicated portfolio. It had 30 to 35 stocks that would be moving. It had a couple derivatives positions above and below it. So it was very hard for any lay investor to understand, and it was so seductive. And if you looked at the return stream, it was a steady 1% a month, and that's what they fell in love with.
But you also say that he didn't fool everyone. Others also saw this.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of people saw or suspected and turned the other way. It was me and my team. We went forward, and there was two other whistleblowers that went forward to the SEC, and that was it.
Well, was he aware of the fact that these people were going to the SEC?
Thank goodness, no.
Well, maybe he would have stopped sooner, don't you think?
No, he might have stopped us sooner, and that's what we feared. He was a very dangerous individual.
Was there a certain profile to his clients?
Yes, you had to be very trusting, and you had to believe that other people that were invested were smarter than you and had checked him out. Therefore, you could abandon all caution.
Would it have been cleverer if he had taken losses once in a while so that it wouldn't have been so obvious?
It certainly would have been. He was up over 96% of the months, and that would be equivalent to a Major League Baseball player batting 960. Given what we know about the ethical climate in Major League Baseball, you'd suspect cheating immediately.
But you say that one of the explanations for his success was that people just saw him as so well-connected and so knowledgeable that he knew more than they did.
Strangely, they did, yet I don't think he knew much about finance. The way he put his portfolio together, he had so many mathematical errors, he shouldn't have been able to beat a positive return.
Well, let's listen to a clip from the now-famous interview of Bernard Madoff at a 2007 roundtable discussion with Justin Fox in October 2007.
You know, in today's regulatory environment, it's virtually impossible to violate rules. And this is something that the public really doesn't understand. And you, if you read things in the newspaper and you see somebody, you know, violate a rule, you say, well, you know, they're always doing this. But you, it's impossible for you to go for a violation to go undetected, certainly not for a considerable period of time. And when you consider the volumes of trading, the trillions of dollars of trading that go on, I mean, our firm, for example, alone, we trade in excess of $1 trillion a year. So, and that's one firm.
When he says that his firm was trading over $1 trillion a year, is he completely lying because the Ponzi scheme required no trading?
He's probably talking about his broker-dealer arm on the 19th floor. That was legitimate. He certainly wasn't trading on the Ponzi scheme, but he wanted to give the appearances that he was. He had web after web of lies surrounding himself, and people couldn't pierce that web of lies because they never asked the obvious questions. They were afraid of him. They were afraid of asking him questions.
And why were they afraid of him?
Because if you asked him questions, he would yell at you, and if you asked one too many, he'd throw you out of his complex, and you would be thrown out of the money club. You were no longer an investor. He'd give you your money back.
Harry Markopoulos is my guest. He's written a book called No One Would Listen, a true financial thriller, which is published by Wiley. Did you ever meet him?
I never met him. Only one member of my team, the investigative journalist Michael Okrant, met him. He had known him socially on the cocktail circuit in New York, went in for a key interview in April 2001, and then published a damaging expose on May 1st, 2001 that should have failed Madoff, but it did not.
Why do you think it didn't?
People didn't know he was managing money, certainly not that size. There was red flag after red flag in Mr. Okrant's article. It was in a very serious hedge fund publication, the number one publication in that industry. Thousands of people must have read it. No one did any due diligence. They all assumed that if it was true, the SEC would have shut him down.
But you also say that they were afraid of him. How do you know that? Did people tell you that he yelled at everybody?
He had called up people that were saying things about him that it couldn't be true. And he'd call people up and tell them they better shut that blankety blank up.
Do you think you pretty much know what was going on? Or if you could meet him, are there certain things that you might ask him?
He doesn't owe me any answers. He owes the answers and accountability to the victims, not me.
How long have you been working in finance?
I started in 1987, and I left the industry in August of 2004 to pursue financial fraud cases full-time against Wall Street.
Well, before Madoff, had you dealt with financial fraud before?
Oh, as soon as I got in the industry, you couldn't help but see it. I was an over-the-counter NASDAQ trader in 1988. I saw fraud every hour, every day.
But not on the scale of Bernard Madoff.
No, nothing on this scale. This is the biggest ever.
You call yourself a quant. What's that?
I use the language of numbers to help me understand finance. So I do everything in mathematical sense. I model everything. I use formulas. I try to describe the real world by building a model to describe the world.
In other words, you're a numbers geek.
Yes.
And is that what you tried to do with Bernard Madoff, or was it just so patently clear that this scheme was a Ponzi scheme that you didn't even have to bother?
It probably took me thousands of hours of math, studying math and doing math calculations to be able to understand in 5 minutes that he was a fraud. It took only 4 hours of mathematical modeling to prove that he was a fraud.
Well, he was consistently showing positive returns regardless of whether the market was rising or falling. You don't have to be a mathematician to notice that.
Surprisingly, thousands of people got willingly invested in him, and many of them held PhDs. They were chartered financial analysts. I don't know what they were thinking, or even if they were thinking at all.
Well, recently a judge decided that people couldn't claim the loss of their imagined money. Maybe they just thought that they were making so much money that they'd gone from investing a few thousand dollars to becoming millionaires that they didn't want to believe that anything else was the truth.
He was the Holy Grail, and if you try to warn people that were in, once in, never out. People would not leave Madoff. You could not warn anybody and get them out of the scheme. However, my team and friends of ours in Boston did warn people from getting in. If you could stop them at the stage before they got in, you could save them, but not if they were already in.
And do you think a lot of people listened to you?
I think a lot. We saved a lot of people. If you look at Boston's financial district and if you look at the financial district in New York, so many, all the professionals at the big firms avoided Madoff. And I think that was thanks, in large part, to my team and our friends and helpers.
But you went to the SEC. How how long after you became suspicious of Madoff did you go to the SEC?
It took a period of months. I didn't go to them until May of 2000. I talked to a close friend there, Ed Mannion, in the Boston regional office, and he had 25 years of industry experience. He believed every word I said. He could actually follow the math once I walked him through it, and he got me the appointment with the director of enforcement, the top enforcement attorney in Boston.
And you weren't ambivalent at all about going there? After all, Madoff was a big star in the financial world.
No, because I had to compete with him, as did every legitimate asset manager in New York, Boston, and other cities. You can't compete with perfection. It's impossible. We all lost business to him, and I was angry about that.
And some people would have suggested that you were just simply angry that a rival was doing better than your firm.
Well, I assure you it was not jealousy. When there's a dirty player on the playing field, you want to go to the referee and have him tossed off the field. In my case, the referee wasn't listening.
Now, why do you think that is? After all, your friend at the SEC saw what you were saying. Why didn't the higher-ups see it?
Because the higher-ups are all securities lawyers who have no basis in finance. They don't understand finance or mathematics or the complex instruments of the 21st century. They're unqualified to hold their positions.
You mentioned red flags. Were any of those red flags secret information?
No, it was publicly obtained information from me and my team. We got it right from Madoff's feeder funds, and he had many feeder funds across the globe.
Were you surprised when they just dismissed your report?
No, shocked is more like it.
Because so what happened? They said, well, we don't find anything here to be concerned about?
The top enforcement attorney in Boston didn't understand a word I said after hello. He was untrained in finance, should have never held that senior of a position in the industry in his agency. He basically trashed the submission upon receipt.
He said that you were just simply trying to tear down a more successful rival?
No, he didn't say anything. I don't think he understood anything I said in the entire meeting. He was untrained in finance. He should never held that job.
Was he a political appointee?
No. In the government, there's a low bid for talent, so they get no talent.
Now, what administration was that?
This would have been the tail end of the Carter administration. I'm sorry, the
Clinton
administration. Clinton, right?
So this is a bipartisan problem at the SEC.
The SEC has failed under both parties' political leadership, under multiple administrations. It's been defanged over a period of decades. They haven't done a meaningful case since Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken.
Well, wasn't the SEC actually created in the 30s to protect investors?
And somehow they perverted their mission to being that of protecting the industry from defrauded investors. They became captive to the industry. They became the shield for the industry to operate with against investors.
My guest is Harry Markopoulos, who is also known as the Madoff whistleblower. His book, No One Would Listen, A True Financial Thriller, is published by Wiley. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Harry Markopoulos, a former securities industry executive who's now become an independent financial fraud investigator. And he was probably the most well-known whistleblower in the Bernard Madoff case. He's written a book called No One Would Listen, A True Financial Thriller. It's published by Wiley. So you went to the SEC and they dismissed you. Did you go anywhere else?
Yes, I tried going to Elliot Spitzer in December of 2002 at the JFK Library in Boston when he was speaking at a Profiles in Courage lecture.
This sounds like just the sort of thing Elliot Spitzer loved. It was his kind of meat, wasn't it?
Well, unless you knew that Elliot Spitzer was also Jewish, was a trust fund baby, invested in hedge funds, and that his family would be invested in it.
So his family was invested in Madoff scheme in one way or another? A lot of people said that they didn't realize they were invested in it.
A lot of the feeder funds lied. They said they were multi-strategy funds doing X, Y, and Z strategies when, in fact, they were 100% Madoff. And they were unscrupulous hedge fund operators, and they lied to their clients, and I hope they get brought to the bar of justice.
Because I did ask Elliot Spitzer about this, and he said, well, we didn't know that we were with Madoff. We only found out after the whole thing collapsed.
That can be true. For a lot of people, unfortunately, it was true. People that came in through Ezra Merkin, they never knew.
But he didn't pursue it.
He didn't pursue it, and I wish I had been braver and met him face-to-face, shook his hand, looked him in the eye, and said, I'm president of the Boston Security Analyst Society. I've got 4,000 members. I'm a derivatives portfolio manager. I manage billions in derivatives portfolios. This is the math. The guy's a fraud. I wish I had done that in December of 2002.
What about going to the press?
I went to the press numerous times. Michael Okrant, we recruited to the team because he was a journalist. He did go to public on May 1st with his article. Aaron Arvidlund of Barron's went public on May 7th, 2001. Millions of readers to Barron's. No one stopped Madoff. And then we went to the press again repeatedly. Michael Okrant went to the New York Times on a number of occasions, and they were looking for a new news peg. And I went to the Wall Street Journal in 2005. They had the case for 3 years.
Were you given any reason that they chose not to pursue this?
Oh, I know what the reason is. And the reason was it was too big and too unbelievable. It was so secretive. And they said, well, if this is something this big of a fraud, it could never exist. And it's several times the size of any known hedge fund. So obviously it can't exist.
I suspect a lot of those places are pursuing you right now, want to do stories on you and do stories on this book.
It's fine. I sort of want to get back to chasing bad guys. That's what I do best.
So are you made uncomfortable by all the attention, the fact that there's talk about making a movie?
I'll deal with Hollywood, but we'll deal with them on our terms. I know what kind of accounting fraud and shenanigans they're known for. I'm not going to let them pull that on me or my team. But, yeah, I'll suffer through the movie, but I don't really want to have any part of the movie.
So you went to the SEC. You went to the press. They ignored you. You went to you said you warned some people off, but you also had a fair number of intelligent people who just didn't listen to you.
Yes, and that's unfortunate because it was so big, so unbelievable. It was a trip through the Twilight Zone where you can see the monster and everybody else sees a respected citizen, a titan of Wall Street, and no one was listening to us. It was amazing.
You had any idea why they didn't believe you? Again, just simply because he was a titan of Wall Street?
I don't think they could follow our math. And I tried to make it so simple and understandable, and I put that in the book so a layperson can understand it. He's supposed to be replicating a 100-stock index. His similarity to that index was only 6%. You would have expected a much higher similarity. Some of the math errors, you did not need to have anything beyond a sixth-grade math education.
And as a result of all these people ignoring you, some of these cases ended rather tragically.
There was so much devastation left in the wake of this case. My team and I never saw the individuals going direct to Madoff. We never conceptualized that someone would have 100% of their money in one basket with one man.
Do you think it was because of the culture at the time? It was almost like everybody's going to get rich. We had the housing bubble. Wall Street was booming.
It was some of that. He was so respected. People didn't know what he was doing. It was complex. They were seduced. He wasn't hitting home runs. He was hitting steady doubles, but an unbelievable clip.
But there's also a feeling that all the checks that are built into the system just weren't being employed.
Well, some of the checks that failed were the big accounting firms that did audits of the feeder funds. They said the assets were there when, in fact, they weren't. You had major big banks, particularly European banks, saying they were custodying assets for Madoff when, in fact, they weren't. They were just turning the money right over to Madoff, and he was sub-custodying the assets. You had third-party plan administrators, mainly offshore, that were keeping score of Madoff's trades and telling you that the performance was legitimate. He never traded. They were keeping score based on fictional numbers.
Well, you say that you're a quant, but most of the people in this business are in a kind of a networking business. It's all about contacts and relationships, isn't it?
And it's a sales-driven culture where people don't understand the products that they're selling. And that's a tragedy, and that's how people get lured into bad investments.
You do business with people you trust and like, people who belong to the same clubs.
People that look, act, and think and were similarly educated to you, and that's a failing. You really have to ask questions. You can't assume that somebody else asked those questions for you.
Do you think that there's been an increase in suspicion since Bernie Madoff? Or it's my sense that this sort of thing makes people a little leery for a little while, and then they go right back to the same sort of thing when the next Madoff comes along.
You're 100% correct. In December and January, after Madoff blew up onto the scene, everybody went to their consultants, went to their custodian banks, and made sure the assets were there and verified performance. In February, all those phone calls stopped.
That soon?
That soon. That's how short-term it was.
Well, it's kind of like what we see with any big story. Haiti was a big story, and then Chile came along, and nobody seems to be talking about Haiti anymore.
In the long term, we forget, and we forget everything.
My guest is Harry Markopoulos, who has written a book about his experiences with the Bernard Madoff case called No One Would Listen, a true financial thriller. It is published by Wiley. How was your team, your investigative team, the team you call Foxhounds, created?
People that I knew, I recruited. And that's how I do all my cases. I recruited Frank Casey because he was a marketing guy and he can keep track of the assets under management. He went to a lot of conferences. We were tracking Madoff across two continents, and we did this case successfully. We had cover stories that we built. We were never telling people we were investigating Madoff. We just asked questions at those conferences. Michael Okrant became director of the conference group for Institutional Investor. He was holding hedge fund conferences. He was collecting information on Madoff. Neil Cello, my protege, he became director of risk management for a large fund of funds on the West Coast. And he would pretend to be wanting to invest large sums of money into these feeder funds, these Madoff feeders. And they would open their kimonos to us, and they would give us the financial statements, the portfolios. We were getting the inside look real time. And that's how we proved our case.
A couple of other Ponzi schemes have been revealed in recent months. So were you looking into those as well, or was Madoff your only real concern?
No, we were tracking the elephant. We left the fleas to others.
Uh-huh. Although a couple of those fleas were rather big fleas.
There's been a billion-dollar one down in Florida, Rothstein. I mean, there's been significant ones. The economic damage from these things, it just lives a wake of destruction of families. That's what's left in the wake.
So there you were telling people that there was something wrong here, and that never really brought them down. What
no.
did bring them down?
The financial, the near collapse of the financial markets in 2008, Madoff was the only manager that was up that year, just about, other than the people that shorted housing. And so people thought he was so liquid, so protected, his portfolios were so safe, they went to him as a safe haven to withdraw assets because their other managers' portfolios were underwater. And he couldn't meet the cash calls, and he collapsed. And he had weeks' notice. He knew when he was going to collapse, and that's why he turned himself in.
He was also running out of clients, wasn't he?
There was not enough new money coming in.
Because a Ponzi scheme requires a lot of money to come in to keep itself going.
He pretty much tapped out Europe. He was going strong in Latin America. His next frontier was Asia. He was just starting up in Asia. And I think his hope was is to bring the Asians on board, but the markets collapsed here before he can get to the Asian community.
Still, he'd been getting new clients for 20 years. That's a long time to keep a Ponzi scheme going.
Oh, I think it was more than just 20 years. I personally can go back to 1981 with him. He started with Ponzi notes. He didn't switch to the derivative split strike conversion until December of 1990 because he knew the SEC couldn't understand derivatives math. That's why he used that as his cover.
So now that we know more about derivatives, and although no laws have been changed, we're probably going to see more regulation in that area. Do you think a Madoff could still come along and do the same sort of thing?
If you keep the same people as banking regulators and SEC agency employees, yes, because they need to swap out the people. Those people have failed us miserably. They need to be replaced, and none of them have. No one's been fired, only promoted, based on this case.
What was your reaction when you found out that he turned himself in?
Tremendous relief. I knew that my family was safe. I was safe. I was no longer living under a death sentence.
Really? You felt it? You felt threatened in that way?
Oh, Madoff was stealing from the Russian mob. He was stealing from the drug cartels. He was stealing from lots of dangerous people and some of the most powerful people in the world. He had a lot to protect. So did the feeder funds that were relying on him for hundreds of millions of dollars in annual income. Any one of those people, if they knew that I was threatening their livelihood, they would have taken extreme measures. And I know that because law enforcement told me that.
But a Ponzi scheme is almost guaranteed to fail at some point. It can only go so far. He'd kept it going for quite a while, but you knew it had to come.
He did. Maybe he thought he could cheat it by dying first. I mean, he was up in age. He was 71 when the scheme collapsed. Maybe he thought he could go another 10 or 15 years. And if the markets hadn't collapsed in 2008, he might well have.
You were relieved, but did you also consider your job done since after he revealed himself?
No, I knew I had one more battle to fight, and that was with the Securities and Exchange Commission. I wanted those investors to know what my team and I did on their behalf, and I wanted to embarrass that agency and take it to its lowest point in history. I wanted the victims to know what happened to their money because the SEC was engaged in a massive cover-up, and I knew that immediately, and I wanted to hold them accountable, and I did in front of the House.
Mm-hmm. You testified before a House committee, and do you think that things are going to change in regard to the SEC? Have you seen any major changes?
They've re-disorganized. They've
re-disorganized?
Re-disorganized long functional lines. They've kept the same people. They're still dominated by securities lawyers. Securities lawyers will never be capable of policing Wall Street. They don't understand what we do on Wall Street. The place needs they need a clean house of the lawyers and bring finance people and put them in positions of responsibility there.
Were you surprised that it was Madoff's sons who revealed that their father had confessed to this Ponzi scheme?
He had weeks foreknowledge of when he was going to collapse. He had weeks to destroy evidence and come up with a plausible cover story, and that's all I'm going to say on that topic.
Because there are many people who wonder whether it would even be possible to be working in the firm and not have some sense that something was wrong.
The way I look at it, his two sons held senior positions of leadership in that broker-dealer arm on the 19th floor. They had to know that they were reporting false net capital requirements to FINRA and to the SEC on a regular basis. His niece was a compliance officer. His brother was the chief compliance officer. They had to be attesting to false filings with the SEC and FINRA. It's the only way to keep that scheme going that long.
We often hear that the people who suffer the most are the whistleblowers, even though there are laws to protect them.
In my cases that I do, the whistleblowers often will end up committing economic suicide. They'll be marginalized. They'll be blacklisted. I take measures in my cases to safeguard their identities and make sure that doesn't happen to them. If you notice, my team came out of this A-OK.
And that's but you weren't working for the SEC. If there had been a whistleblower at the SEC who insisted on pursuing this, he probably would have been fired.
That was my concern for Ed Mannion in the Boston office. So when I met with Barney Frank, the House Financial Services Committee chairman's special counsel, before I testified, I asked that they protect Ed Mannion to make sure there were no retaliation against him as an SEC agency employee, because he was pressing this case forward continually within the SEC.
Would you like to see the laws changed in some ways?
I'd like to see over-the-counter derivatives regulated. I'd like to see hedge funds regulated. I'd like to see one single regulator with one computer system. I don't want to see six different financial regulators with six different computer systems out there.
I wonder whether anyone at the SEC has come to you with some sort of apology.
Actually, yes. I have had met with several agency employees that have been very forthcoming, thanking me profusely, shaking my hand. It's been very meaningful to me. It's brought me to tears. I can tell you that the SEC Inspector General is a hero to me, along with his entire Inspector General team. Those people conducted a massive investigation. They went without sleep many nights. They lived in the offices, basically, and wrote a true, honest, and hard-hitting report that they released the day before the Labor Day weekend.
You've left the finance industry. When and why did you decide to leave?
I pretty much was bored with the math on Wall Street. I hadn't seen any new math in years. I was bored with the industry. It was same old, same old. And I wanted to chase bad guys. Madoff really got my blood boiling. I wanted to fight corruption, and I thought I could be good at it. I thought I could do the big cases that are important to this country. And so I've gone on and done that.
So if the Madoff thing hadn't fallen into your lap, you think you'd still be at your old job?
Probably, regrettably. And I'm so happy what I'm doing. I'm doing some very large cases that you'll be hearing about soon, where companies are stealing tens of millions of pension accounts. They're just looting our pension accounts, and I'm going to be bringing those cases to the forefront in the near future.
Well, people will pay attention, but you said that it also put you in danger. Won't you be endangered in the future?
No, I'm only going to do white-collar cases against corporate America. I'm never going to do another organized crime case, and that's what Madoff was at its essence. It was a global organized criminal conspiracy.
I get the feeling that you're a bit upset by a certain amount of loss of privacy. What's going to happen when they make a movie based on this book?
Well, it'll be different actors, so they won't know what I look like. So I'm fortunate about that.
I know what you look like, and we're taking hidden photographs.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I do disguises when I go out into the field now. I can tell you what one of them is, and it's so embarrassing because I'm from Boston. But on occasion, I'll actually don a Yankees cap.
Well, you won't get any attention if you're wearing a Yankees cap in Boston. Looking back, do you wish that you'd acted differently in any way, both to have been more effective and also to have made things easier on yourself?
Yes, I regret 2002 not meeting with Mr. Spitzer directly. I felt that he was the number one prime law enforcer on Wall Street. He was the tough cop on the beat. The SEC wasn't asleep with the switch. They were comatose. They barely responded to heat and light.
And he was going after people like Bernard Madoff.
He was getting billions of dollars in recovery for defrauded investors, along with Secretary of the State for Massachusetts, William Galvin. Those are the only two regulators we had in this country that were watching Wall Street. The SEC couldn't have cared less.
Harry Markopoulos's book, No One Would Listen, A True Financial Thriller, is published by Wiley. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.